My name is Ginny Nelson, and my interest in hunger has basically, you know, as you can tell, I'm fairly young, and I've been involved in the hunger issue for probably about 6 years now, more actively in leadership for the past 3 years, and I do a lot of speaking and resource work on the hunger issue, and I like to speak of myself as an advocate. And what I mean by an advocate is someone who speaks for those who cannot speak for themselves. I'm going to be talking about some of the basic systemic causes of hunger. And I'd like to start by finding out how much you know. So I want to just, I don't have a little easel or anything, but we'll just write, I'll write them down and we'll hold them up afterwards. And I'd like you to give me what you see as some of the basic causes for world hunger.
Maldistribution.
Okay, maldistribution. Why don't we just say distribution in all the... Okay. Right. You can just keep saying.
Overpopulation.
Overpopulation.
Lack of know-how.
Lack of know-how, like appropriate technology, would that be right? Okay.
McDonald's.
Okay.
Economics, people growing crops for export instead of consumption.
Okay, export cropping, that's a big one.
Let's put greed in there somewhere.
Oh, let's put that at top. Let's put that on top. Greed. Anything else? We've got greed, distribution or maldistribution, overpopulation, inappropriate technology. Export cropping. Anything else? How about famine? Kind of a, that's one that we pretty much know, you know, it's a common cause of hunger.
War.
Pardon me?
War.
War is a big one.
I think our country's at fault in a lot of, in many ways, because we want them to be like us, but we don't give them the tools or the know-how to do for themselves in their culture. I don't know how you can put that in.
Right, well, I think maybe that would be putting a few of these together with inappropriate technology and how about trade laws, which goes with export, maybe with the exports, but that would fit in with that.
We keep them down even while we want them to be up.
Right. How about military spending? That might be something controversial, but I'll have put that as my my contribution. Hi, come on in. How about a real common one? Unemployment. Somebody's hungry because they're unemployed. Big reason here in the United States right now. Could we put down, maybe not, some of these are indirect, but how about multinationals? I'm just going to put that down as another one of my... Okay, well, we've got a lot right now. We'll just start out with this. We've got quite a bit to start with. We have greed, distribution, overpopulation, inappropriate technology, export cropping, or we could say cash crops. Single export cropping, crop exports, famine, war, trade laws, military spending, unemployment, and multinationals. Okay, we'll come back to this. I want you to start by using your imagination. So I'd like you to close your eyes, and I want you to envision your house, your apartment, wherever it is that you call home. And we're going to transfer your home into the type of dwelling that most people in the third world live in. And I want to say that I just want to start this because I think that we never can separate the larger causes from that this is affecting people like you and me. Okay. And I want to just give credit. This is from Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger by Ron Sider. Okay, we begin, now you need to put your imagination caps on. We begin by invading your house. We start by stripping it of its furniture. Everything goes, bed, chairs, tables, television sets, lamps. We will leave your family with a few old blankets, a kitchen table, and a wooden chair. Along with the bureaus go the clothes. Each member of your family may keep in his or her wardrobe his or her oldest suit or dress or shirt and blouse. We will permit, come on in if you're we will permit a pair of shoes for the head of the family, but none for the wife and children. There's some room over here. We move to the kitchen. The appliances have already been taken out, so we turn to your cupboard. A box of matches may stay, a small bag of flour, some sugar and salt. A few moldy potatoes already in the garbage can must be hastily rescued, for they will provide much of your tonight's meal. We will leave a handful of onions, a dish of dried beans. All the rest we take away, the meat, the fresh vegetables, the canned goods, the crackers, the candy. Now we have stripped your house. Your bathroom has been dismantled, the running water shut off, the electric wires taken out. Next, we move away the house. The family can move to the tool shed. Communications must go next. No more newspapers, magazines, books. Not that they've been missed, since we must take away your family's literacy as well. Instead, in our shanty town, we will allow one radio. Now, government services must go. No more post person, no more fire person. There is a school, but it is 3 miles away and consists of 2 classrooms. There are, of course, no hospitals or doctors nearby. The nearest clinic is 10 miles away and is tended by a midwife. It can be reached by bicycle, provided the family has a bicycle, which is unlikely. Finally, money. We allow your family a cash hoard of $5. This will prevent your breadwinner from experiencing the tragedy of an Iranian peasant who went blind because he could not raise the $3.94 which he mistakenly thought he needed to receive admission to a hospital where he could have been cured. Well, I just wanted to start with that because that is the conditions that most of the world live in. And not even outside of the United States any longer. I'd like now to read just a few scriptures, and I want to give credit to some of the books that I'm using today in case you might be interested in reading them. And all of these can be found in the library. This one's called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger by Ron Sider, and it's an excellent biblical study of the hunger issue. This is a very good one as well, and this is called Hunger for Justice, The Politics of Food and Faith by Jack Nelson. He works for Church and Laity Concerned, at least he used to. I think now he works for the ALC in Minnesota. And what I'm going to first be reading some scriptures from Amos. Therefore, because you trample upon the poor and take from them exactions of wheat, and you have built houses of hewn stone, but you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink their wine. Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath, that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may have the epeth small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and sell refuse of wheat? The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their deeds. And that's from Amos 8. 4 through 7. And then now I'd like to finish the scripture readings by reading the first, the words that Jesus began his ministry with from Luke 4, 18 and 19. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. I am starting today with some assumptions, and I think I need to tell you my assumptions, and they might not be yours. By the title, it was called A Hidden Holocaust Hunger. In World War II, I wasn't alive, but through my reading, it was told to me in different books that there were many people who knew that the Holocaust was going on, but that no one did anything about it. Well, I feel that there is a Holocaust going on today, and that Holocaust is hunger. Just as the Holocaust in World War II could have been prevented through some, what some people say, some very specific types of action, such as bombing the railway as one method, we also can be preventing hunger. There are a lot of different reasons that people are hungry, but one thing that many experts will agree on is that if things were changed, and we're not sure whether they will be changed, people needn't be hungry. And that, to me, is the scourge, as one author calls, of hunger, that we allow this to continue to happen when it doesn't need to be happening. I'm going to be reading from this book, also Bread and Justice by James McGinnis, and he does an exposition on the New International Economic Order, which basically is one of the ways that he feels possibly this issue can be dealt with. I'd like to read you something having to do with the idea that we could be feeding the whole world. And this comes from The Lean Years by Richard Barnett. He also wrote Global Reach, which has to do with multinationals. Every day, the world produces 2 pounds of grain for every man, woman, and child on Earth. That is sufficient to provide 3,000 calories a day for everyone, even without the enormous quantities of meat, fish, vegetables, and fruit that are produced each year. The fact that people are hungry is due less to insufficient food production than, as to one person said, maldistribution. Most people who stop eating do so not because there is insufficient food growth in the world, but because they no longer grow it themselves and do not have the money to buy it. And that brings us to one of the first systemic causes that we could talk about, and that is unemployment. Well, why are people unemployed? There are a lot of different reasons in different parts of the world why people are unemployed. We could take our list and just look and see that unemployment can stem from a lot of these reasons. Greed. Because I'm going to be using a term which is the basis for most of the multinational corporations, well, not only multinational corporations, but most corporations, and that's maximization of profit. Maximization of profit does not necessarily take into regard human what humans need. It's having to do with profit, and so greed can often lead to people being unemployed in that technology has replaced people, which in some cases is good, in some cases is bad. So we're talking about unemployment, distribution. I think maybe what I'm going to do right now is go down the list
and unemployment will be coming up through all these things. But distribution. How many of you here are involved or know someone directly, like let's say in your family, who is involved in farming? Right, there's a lot of you, most of you. I mean, the United States is the breadbasket of the world. Well, we come from South Dakota, which one of the largest, the largest form of, for the gross national product of South Dakota is agriculture. So this hits us very directly. And to not try to sound too trite or too simplistic, we find that distribution or maldistribution is a large problem, and we see that with our farmers in South Dakota, that they are able to produce large crops and yet receiving in terms of relative of the dollar value much less for their crops now than they were 15 years ago. I'd like to talk a little bit about multinationals now in terms of distribution. And all this deals with hunger. I hope you realize that. Is that, does everyone know what a multinational corporation is? I'll just name a few. And I'm going to name a few that have directly to do with distribution of grain. There are five grain companies that effectively control all of the grain. You're looking at each other.
Just read them.
Okay. Well, maybe you've heard of these names before. Cargill, which is a multinational grain corporation that started in Wisconsin. Continental, Bungie.
It's Bungie.
Bungie.
U-N-G-E. That's Bungie. What he was laughing. That's my maiden name.
Oh, is it? Are you from that family?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Bungie. Oh, my. Well, I hope I don't say anything that gets me in too much trouble then. Louis Dreyfus and André, a French-based company. These five companies effectively control the price of grain throughout the world. We have this feeling that we have this independent farmer who lives in, let's take my state, South Dakota, and that, you know, he's making a living. If he works hard, he'll get a good price. But it gets a little bit more complicated than that, because when the North Dakota Commissioner for Agriculture was asked to describe the grain companies to a Senate subcommittee on multinational corporations, this is basically how he put it. The pyramid of power, as I see it, is that 30,000 North Dakota farmers selling through 500 grain elevators in North Dakota, farmer-owned, but discreetly Minneapolis-run, in my estimation, which would be Cargill in Minneapolis, into one grain exchange, which in turn sells mostly to six large exporters. So you know the grain moves in that direction. So you see the pyramid of power comes to an incredibly sharp peak. You say, well, how does this have to do with poverty? Well, it has very directly to do with poverty, in that if you have five companies controlling the grain prices on an international market, you have not a monopoly, but what is called a cartel. They're basically able to tell what prices are going to be. They don't farm. They don't go out and own the land. But because it is funneled through these five companies, and not only do they buy the grain, but they oftentimes own the grain elevators that are at the docks where it's shipped out. They're also in shipping, and so you really have a very hard time getting around it. And so the farmer is not getting the price that I feel he should be getting for his crops, because these grain companies are being able to effectively hold out to hold the grain and not buy until, let's say, the demand is higher and the prices can go up. But who is getting the raised price for that grain is the exporter, not the farmer himself. This is a very simplistic way of putting this. So those of you who know a lot about this, please bear with me. How this affects the international community is that there was an example in Zaire where the people of Zaire wanted to begin to process their own grain. Well, Continental happened to be the company in that country, and they said, no, you can't do that, because then what would have happened was, if they could have processed the grain themselves, they could have offered the grain at the bread, which is what they were making, at a lower price. So basically what Continental did was stopped shipment to Zaire. They had an uprising on their hands, and they effectively put that down. And what was the result of that was that Continental got in writing from that country that they would exclusively only buy from the company Continental. So the people are paying inflated prices, and many of the people in the first hand are not even being able to afford this. And so in terms of distribution, you have crops being distributed, not only not reaching certain areas because they don't have the trucking types of equipment that we have to get across country, but also at the very start of the whole system in having to pay higher prices. This leads me into wanting to talk about export cropping. Do any of you know what a cash crop is? Give me an example of what a cash crop
is. All farmers need a cash crop.
Well, but what's called just a cash crop?
Coffee.
Tea.
Bananas.
Chocolate.
Sugar.
Cotton.
Yeah, those are probably the largest cash crops. A lot of people are being what I would call held hostage in poverty because of what I call the spiral of debt, which links to single export cropping. I'd like to take a specific example of a country that has very high level of malnutrition, which is the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic, the multinational corporation that is in the Dominican Republic, is Gulf and Western. So they produce not just one cash crop, but two major cash crops. The first being sugar cane, and the second being cattle. And most of these cows and the cattle is being then processed and shipped back and processed in the first world. Why is it that people in a country such as the Dominican Republic have one of the highest levels of malnutrition when they have beautiful lush land that is able to grow crops? It has to do with export, single or very few export cropping. If you, let's say you were a farmer in South Dakota and you had a piece of land, this is using a little different angle, but let's say you lived in the outskirts of Sioux Falls like we do. We live in Sioux Falls, but let's say there was a mall coming in and you could get, let's say, $10,000 an acre. I'm just throwing out a figure. And you owned, and that particular company wanted to buy 30 acres. Well, you could make more cash off that land in the short period of time than you could farming that land for however many years. So that land is worth more being sold off for a use that is not used for to feed the people in the area. And this is what's happening throughout the United States, more and more land taking up from highways, buildings and whatever. But let's take the example of Dominican Republic. In the Dominican Republic, the land is worth more for them to put in to selling and raising sugarcane and cattle. And so more and more farmers are being bought out, let's say marginal farmers who don't own very much land. Oftentimes maybe they don't want to sell, but there is outside pressure that they have to sell. So I want to explain the spiral. We start here. Cheaper exports, costlier imports. Okay, so the Dominican Republic is using more and more of its land to grow sugarcane and cattle. Well, sugarcane is not a nutritional product, and secondly, probably 80% of the population cannot afford beef. So what are they having to do? They're having to import their food. So, but they're importing processed foods. So they're exporting sugarcane, they're exporting the cattle, and they're having to import the food to feed their people. So you go around. So they're in debt because their imports cost more than their exports. Well, there's the balance of commerce, balance of trade. They have to take a loan out for their imports. Debt payments. And we go around. Loans for past loans. You know, if any of you have ever had a home, we've never owned a home, but I know my parents told us they once time got in a financial bind, they had to remortgage their home. Well, this is the same kind of idea. They're having to refinance their loans for past loans. Greater debt payments. And now, repartition of, and that I want to say that MNC means multinational profits. Because oftentimes what's happening is the land that is being used is not being used, let's say the profits are not all going to the people in their country for the sugarcane and the beef, because it's a multinational corporation that's there. They have less capital, more loans, greater debt payments, and it just keeps spiraling down. So that a person who is cutting sugarcane in the Dominican Republic can't even afford to buy the sugarcane that's processed, you know, to have for his family, his or her family. What happens when you have a single export for, and this is, I would say, one of the classic reasons that on a national level, a lot of countries in the third world are in the poverty situation they are in. The United States, let's say, they deal in billions of tons, let's say 1 million tons of sugarcane from the Dominican Republic. Let's say the Dominican Republic begins to say, hey, we want to change our form of government, we want to get unions in, we want to get higher wages. The United States says, okay, well, we have Honduras here who wants to sell us their sugar cane, and we just don't have to buy your sugar cane. Well, what kind of position does that put them in? It's kind of like the dilemma of bananas. I always feel guilty. Oh, I shouldn't eat any bananas. But then if you don't eat the bananas, then they don't eat, you know. So we stop buying the product, and then the people starve because they don't have work. And this is what's happening in many areas, is that people, if they have a single crop, particularly a crop that isn't necessarily vital to us, if coffee goes up too high, don't you think you might cut down on your coffee intake? And this is what has started to happen, is that often there's more countries who import coffee, so now Africa is starting to get into exporting coffee. And so they'll say to, let's say, a Central American country, well, we just won't buy coffee from you anymore.
And then how do they pay off their debts? To illustrate this a little bit more, I'll take the example of talking about how there is all this money they're making, but how little of the money stays in the country itself. This is kind of a bad visual. My husband's the artist here. He did not make this visual. I did. The example of when bananas were 20 cents a pound. This is a breakdown. This is supposed to be a banana. In Honduras. Okay, 1.8 cents stays in Honduras, having to do with wages and taxes. And I was surprised it even had taxes, because another element to this is a lot of these countries, or the reason multinationals move into these countries is they offer tax-free, they're not taxed on the income. Okay, 2.7 to the multinationals in Honduras, which means the branch, the national branch of that multinational organization. All right, then 12 cents of it goes outside to the multinational. I want to say right now, I am not basically against multinationals, but these seem to be facts about them. You can make your own decision. Outside Honduras, markups, freight, insurance, handling, and then 3.5 cents for the retail markup that you find in the store. So we're talking about 15.5 cents of that 20 cents going outside of the economy of that country. Well, then you don't have the flow of cash staying in the country. I mean, haven't you ever heard of someone complaining about how all the people moving out into the suburbs and the cities are collapsing because they don't have the revenue in the cities? Well, it's the same type of situation, except it's happening on a national, an international level. Okay. Overpopulation. I like to talk about this one. There are organizations that are devoted entirely to the study and interest of population control. I have to tell the story because I found it very interesting. My husband was on a radio show talking about world hunger, and this woman was just very, very irate, and she said, "What is going to happen? All of these people." These were her words. All these yellow people are having more and more babies, and all of the white people are having abortions and no more babies, and now these yellow people are going to take over the world, and what are we going to do, and how are we going to protect ourselves? And these were real concerns of this woman. Well, it's very hard to answer a type of emotional rhetoric like that, because it's something that's coming from, it's not based on what I would consider rational thought, but that's my opinion. But the idea is that it's true. In the third world, the populations are growing at incredible rates. So we go into countries such as India and teach them about birth control, and the population rates continue to be the same. What do you think, I just want to throw this out, what do you think if we would go into a section of India, what do you think would be the best way to help population control in that area that would be quite poor?
Raise the standard of living.
Exactly. The most direct correlation between population decrease is an improved economy. Because think of it, if you were a poor person in a country and you were thinking in terms of having to make a living, the more people you have working for you, the more money you're going to make, the more mouths you're going to have to feed. But when you have a mortality rate in some of these countries being 40%, you have 8 children, you're thinking about 4 of them dying before they reach the age of 5. So you're thinking in terms of maybe perhaps only 3 of them reaching adulthood. And in most of these countries, children then have to take care of the parents. So it's only sane security to have more children. Because the more children that you have, the more secure you are in your old age. And so they're finding that, as you said, the more that you can make the economy stable and give people the basic needs they have to have, food, shelter,
clothing, medical care. The population immediately begins to decrease. So I think that's one myth that I think is easily countered by saying you aren't ever going to get people to have fewer children until you increase and improve their economic conditions. Inappropriate technology, someone said. It's interesting that I don't know if you've ever encountered this, my husband's been teaching college for 9 years, and so we become in contact with a lot of international students who come over here to study, and lots of them come over to study agriculture and doctors and lots of other things. But up until, I think, fairly recently, they were studying agriculture in a temperate climate, with our types of technology, which was not appropriate at all for the types of situations that they were going back to. It would be like trying to study medicine and only studying the medical diseases in a, let's say, Washington, and you go down to a country like Honduras, and you're not going to know how to deal with those diseases because you haven't even seen them. And so, Art, you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but I'm hoping, I don't know for a fact, but I'm hoping that they're beginning to teach more appropriate types of technology to take back to these countries, so that not only, I mean, there are certain crops that you can't grow in certain areas. Did you want to say something?
There is a book that I've just been reading, it's been put out by the Sierra Club, but it talks about someone who was to study the Andes and the Arizona farming and the Amish people and the way that they farm. And this person who worked with an agriculture student from William and Mary said in the Andes talked about how that the people that kept the land going there had been farming for 4,500 years. And using, and the crop, the soil erosion was minimal compared to what was happening in Arizona when we were using the big tillers, all the other kinds of machinery. Mm-hmm. The varieties of potatoes that they had and kept the disease down and all that kind of thing. All the things that we talk about, improvement, sounds like it would be disastrous for other countries that have learned how to reap the land and to do the agriculture.
Yeah.
In the way that they
Egypt is a good example because now they have the dam and the Nile doesn't flood, so
right.
The land is going to pot. Mm.
It's very interesting that we're starting to find that the ecological balance, if you begin to mess with it, it's going to turn on you and you're going and you're it's not like it can continue forever. And I in this light, there's an interesting book I'd like to recommend by a man who works in the ALC National Office, Chuck Lutz, and it's called Farming the Lord's Land, and it deals with some of these types of issues on a domestic level, having to do with the United States and some of the problems that we're starting to face. So appropriate technology is vital, because when you have a country like China, with how many people do they have? You know, you use people power. It's wiser to use people power rather than bringing in large tractors and things like that. I talked a little bit about cropping. Famine. How many of you have heard of the famine in the Horn of Africa? It's gotten a lot of publicity. And this is a case where you'd say, you've got something on it right there in the Lutheran Standard.
No, it wasn't April Fool's Day either, but it was printed then.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it was.
Well, that's a situation where if you didn't look into it a little bit deeper, you'd say, oh, that's just a case of famine. But that's much more than a case of famine. You know, it's a very complicated situation of we talked about war causing hunger. Well, this is a direct advent of war in Ethiopia, and other famines that have happened. You find that oftentimes they're not as simple as you think. In one of the books, in fact, it was this book talking about how, I guess I didn't put my little note card in there, how it breaks my heart, but there was a flood in the 1800s, and I forget which, famine, and talking about how certain people made an incredible profit off that famine. Let's go on to the next one, trade laws. Okay, I want to say right now that I have never taken an economics course, and I have been reading all of these books, such as this one, going, I really need to take a basic economics course. Equality, the Third World, and Economic Delusion. This is a new book that's come out that's very interesting. And this book basically has to do with economics as well. Having to do with trade laws, I'd just like to introduce now a concept that I hope you'll be hearing more about, and that's the new international economic order. And the four basic tenets of the basic goals of the new international economic order is the redistribution of wealth, appropriate models of development and technology, redistribution of power, and interdependence. And that redistribution of power would both be internationally and within national structures. It's a very, it's been tried to be adopted by the UN for many years, and the United States and some of the other large countries, the first world countries, have blocked it. But basically, and the nuts and bolts of it would be having to have a restructure of some of the trade laws. I think the easiest way is to explain a specific situation in terms of trade laws, because I find it to be all very confusing. Trade laws keep people hungry, and they keep nations in debt, and it goes back to the idea of the export cropping we're talking about. But let's take an example of Brazil. Brazil is now one of the largest soybean producers in the world, along with the United States. However, we or another country will buy, we won't buy, we export soybeans, but let's say a first world country such as West Germany would buy the soybeans from Brazil. They will buy the soybeans, raw soybeans, for a low tariff, which means having to pay a certain amount to have it enter the country. The more processed those soybeans are, the higher the tariff is, so that that country cannot afford to process those soybeans and make a profit as well because of the high tariffs. And this is, as again, as I'm saying, keeping it very simple. But basically, it keeps countries at what a lot of books call captive to the first world system, because most of what the third world has is a lot of raw products that we allow and we import in large quantities. However, in a way, it makes a lot of sense, except it keeps them down. We don't want them to process them, because why? It's a very simple reason. Why don't we want them to process them?
We want the jobs.
Yes, we want the jobs, which
process
makes
more money to bring them back then too.
Yes, and that makes sense. But is there some fundamental types of questions that we have to say here? I'm sure we have people here of both partisan views, but one thing that President Reagan said when he was running for office that disturbed me was that we want to stay number one, and we will never give up being number one. And something that hurt me deeply about that is that the truth is the only reason that we are able to stay number one is because we keep other people number 236th and 237th, and with our level of lifestyle is directly connected to the level of lifestyle in other people's lands. And I am not to say that we are to relieve all trade restrictions, but we need to say, are we going to stay number one at the level we are at, on the backs of people who cannot realize their own destiny and have a, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wonder, do you have an example of a crop that the United States imports where these trade laws are restrictive? I mean, soybeans is not a good example, because
okay,
we export soybeans, and the thing that hurts Brazil and East Germany also.
Right. It was having to do with making gloves, and I don't know. Yes, I have a few examples, and they're in this book, of products that.
Because my guess would be that there's really very few products, you know, in terms of our gross national product, that are affected like that.
Well, okay, let's say some of the things that have to do with high technology.
Those aren't coming from third world countries.
Yeah, well, but products, raw products are coming from third world countries that have to do with the making of some of the tech, you know, the high tech products.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, maybe what I should do is for the sake of okay. Black bean. I don't want to take time right now. Maybe we could talk individually. Because what time is it now? It's probably
4:50.
4:50. Yes, we're getting. But that's a good question. Military spending. A lot of people have different views of how military spending affects, if there's a direct correlation or not. But it's interesting. If you would become a member of Bread for the World, and for those of you who came in late, hope I didn't give them all away, but I have a basic brochure from Bread for the World, of which I'm the state coordinator. And if you join Bread for the World, you get a newsletter every month having to do with food legislation and legislation that Bread for the World is working on. And here it says the House and the Senate votes on, this just came out, I just got this yesterday, supplemental appropriation bill for fiscal 1983 have ensured that the military and security aid will be substantially increased once again. The House voted on an increase of $474 million, and the Senate voted for $887 million, and they have to come to a compromise. Then you go in the very same issue, you see that since 1981, food stamps have lost $11.25 billion and $2 million annually, and that it's eliminated nearly 1 million recipients. And so you say, is there a correlation? When you make your budget for your home, you have only so many dollars. And if dollars aren't going in one place, they're going somewhere else. And so the only logical evaluation that I can make from saying that the military budget is going to be increased from somewhere between $400 to $800 million, that $400 to $800 million has got to come out of somewhere else. And so maybe I'll just leave it at that and say that for myself personally, I believe there is a direct correlation. And I didn't make this session to be getting into that direct issue, but I see it as an issue, as a direct correlation. Bread for the World puts out background papers talking about specific types of angles of looking at hunger. This one has to do with unemployment in the United States. And this really struck me. Although current high unemployment has resulted in heavy demands for food and shelter assistance in nearly all U.S. communities. The problem of long-term unemployment is most severe in communities in which the major employer has initiated mass layoffs or has permanently closed a plant. This is the case of Hartville, Ohio. On April 11, 1983, more than 12,000 people waited in line to apply for 75 entry-level factory jobs at a rubber plant. And according to an official of that plant, at least one-third of the applicants had been laid off from other local rubber and steel plants. And that comes to my closing remarks about hunger, in that in the past we've talked about hunger mainly having to do with it in terms of other countries. The city of Detroit is having an incredible increase in its infant mortality rates. We're seeing people who have been what we would call blue collar, some white collar, lots of single parent families who are having to make choices in the United States between paying their fuel bills or eating. A case came to me right before we left of a family who had always worked, both parents had worked. The man ruptured a disc. He couldn't work for 12 weeks, but they couldn't qualify for food stamps because their level of income had been too high the months before. They owned a home, so that the welfare was going to put a lien against their home. People are having crisis types of situations. These aren't people who don't want to work. That's a situation where a man can't work. But let's take an example of a person who, in our city, we have a large meat packing company, Morrell's. A man who's worked all his life at $11, $12 an hour, and it's probably higher than that. And he's suddenly been laid off. He owns a home. He owns perhaps two cars. He owns a snowmobile, something like that. His lifestyle goes into crisis, particularly if that plant closes. There's a statistic here that says that there was a plant in New Jersey. 2 years later, there are still people who are unemployed. At this point, probably they've sold their home, they've sold their cars, which exacerbates the problem because then they can't go and look for work. They don't have a car if they don't live in a place with mass transit. And I guess in 1976 we passed a resolution called the Right to Food Resolution, stating that we felt that it was a basic right of every person to have food, that it was not a commodity, it was a right. And I think that with some of these statistics that we're hearing, that perhaps that we're having to reevaluate whether we truly believe that as a nation, if we truly believe that food is a right of every human being, and particularly those people within our borders of the United States. We are currently doing a study called Hunger Watch USA, which is a county-by-county survey of the effects of the budget cuts from 1981 and to the present on food-related programs, such as food stamps, WIC, which is Women's, Infants, and Children, which is a supplemental food program for pregnant and breastfeeding women and their children, the supplemental food programs for child care programs, elderly nutrition, the supplemental food programs, the federal government supplements the programs in the schools. We're seeing incredible cuts in these programs. And some people, such as in Sioux Falls, elderly people, the only good meal they have during the day is when they come to the congregate dining. So we are trying to put names and faces onto some of these people in our counties. Being done nationwide, but also to get some statistical background of exactly what is happening, not only in these programs, but in private agencies such as you work in.
It wasn't a private, that's federal.
Is it?
Sure, senior nutrition.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it'd be one of those programs that will be affected by the cuts. Yeah.
Affected.
Yeah. And so you're seeing people who
are going into crisis. And
we're putting out an awful lot of money in our nation to store a lot of food, and we're paying the farmers now to cut back on milk and all kind of commodities. I think we're going about this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the food is there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we're finding, in where I am from, that I hear stories about misuse of this food that's being distributed. People are making money
mm-hmm.
out of distributing it. I think those are areas we have to look at.
Right. And that is, I think that that's very true. I think, unfortunately, that those isolated cases have been made as a basis for saying that these programs are no longer needed.
No, it's like
and
food stamps.
Yeah.
Or like welfare. You get that.
The food is there, but it needs to be distributed by local, more local involvement. And it's being stored. We're paying a lot of taxes for food being stored.
Yeah,
I heard Coretta King in a little excerpt the other day on the television, just, I don't know, I was in the kitchen or something, and she talked about the billions of dollars of food that's stored in the United States. And I think her quote was, it costs $600,000 a week
mm-hmm.
to store this food. So, all right, what's that? $2,400,000 a month to store the food, and if the food was distributed, it could feed for a long, long time all the hungry people in the United States.
Mm. And
so all both agreed. So what are we going to do about it? I mean, what can we, you and I, and whole talk goes right back to greed.
Yeah, but when that food is released, it upsets the local economies again.
Well,
yeah.
There you are again.
So yeah. There's farmers going broke because of this.
Right, and that, and that's, and those of you who want to go, that's fine, but that really points to, as you said, you release it into the economy, and then what happens? I think what you said about having it being distributed by private organizations is a good point. It's what the federal government is finding a lot now is they can't find private organizations that are willing to distribute it, like the cheese. Thank you very much.